Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, the Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. If you're new to the show, you'll be happy to learn that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. You can subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights throughout the month. And if you prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite listening platform. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Over the last 3 years, we've built a great lineup of guests in the field of lung cancer, and today's expert certainly adds to the list. Dr. Carolyn Presley, an assistant professor and oncologist with The Ohio State University and the James Cancer Center, is here today to discuss gaps in knowledge and care delivery that burden patients with lung cancer, as well as the pivotal role that oncologists play in detecting and initiating care for lung cancer. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Presley.
Thank you for having me.
Just to level set for our audience, will you please tell us a little bit about what your current role is at your practice and your institution regarding diagnosing and treating patients with lung cancer?
Absolutely. So I'm a geriatric and thoracic oncologist at The Ohio State University and the James Cancer Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. So we're in South Central Ohio, right in the middle of the country. And I am a lung cancer doctor, but I'm also board certified in geriatrics. And I lead a research program that focuses on improving functional status and quality of life, particularly for older adults with lung cancer. I'm also the associate medical director for our oncogeriatrics program at The Ohio State University.
Very good. You sound well qualified to answer our questions today. So let's start out. The patient diagnosed with lung cancer today often has a much different journey in their care than those diagnosed 15 or 20 years ago. There's been an advent of low-dose lung cancer screening, hoping to shift the diagnosis to earlier, more curable and treatable stages. And as you know, there's been an explosion of new therapies and targeted mutations and immunotherapy. With this change, have you seen a change in the role of the medical oncologist when it comes to lung cancer care? And what I mean by that is there's a wide breadth of cancers, both hematologic, solid organs, that an oncologist is asked to deal with. Do you see more medical oncologists specializing in lung cancer because of the amount of information that's there? And is there amount of specific training that has to be focused for individuals who want to go into thoracic cancers?
Wow, great. Really great question. First off, I think it's important to remember that in the United States, the majority of all cancer care is actually done in the community oncology setting. So it's not necessarily in the academic setting, right? So really making sure that we are providing sort of the gold standard for lung cancer diagnosis, screening, diagnosis, and then treatment planning, there are really some critical components. And screening, we know we still have a long way to go to improve screening rates in terms of making sure that everyone who meets criteria is getting screened. And I think we still have a lot of work to do here. We've made a lot of progress. We know that it improves mortality if we're able to do lung cancer screening. But we know that not everybody that should be getting screened is. And so there are a lot of national efforts to continue to increase not only lung cancer screening, but also improve smoking cessation rates as well. But we like to say anybody with lungs can get lung cancer. And we know that there's still 20% of people who are never smokers. And radon is the number one environmental exposure that we also need to educate people about, specifically in the middle part of the country. The radon levels and exposures are much higher, but I think that there's still an education and public awareness gap of understanding the risk of radon exposure and how that is the number one environmental risk factor that we need to be educating and looking for in our communities. So, but then once patients, if they are screened or if they are having symptoms, really making sure that we get a good tissue diagnosis is key, because that will really dictate the next treatments and whether or not it's confined to the lung or if it's in the lymph nodes. That really contributes to the staging. And so the hope is, though, that over time, we continue to diagnose it more or even prevent it.
During my early years of training, tumor boards have been around for a long time. But more recently, we hear a lot about the development of multidisciplinary teams, certainly around the screening centers that do the early low-dose CT screening, and lung cancer diagnosis as well. There's multidisciplinary teams pre- and post-diagnosis. And that helps to decide, I guess, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. So tell me how a role of the medical oncologist has changed a little bit since screening came into place and with all the newer modalities.
Yeah, so the medical oncologist typically has been the quarterback of the team. And I really see that role continuing, because systemic treatments are not just for the advanced setting. And so when I say systemic treatments, I mean pills by mouth or an infusion of either chemotherapy or immunotherapy or a combination of both. And so the multi-D tumor boards are critical, and we're seeing that across the country, whether you're in the community setting or the academic setting. We know that treatment planning done as a multi-D team, we know the outcomes are better. And so we're seeing that rapid dissemination. We're also seeing virtual tumor boards if we can't do it in person. So I highly recommend that. And because the sequencing of the treatment is becoming incredibly important, we know now that some patients will need chemotherapy and immunotherapy before surgery, right? Or they'll need a combination of chemotherapy and radiation therapy, and then they'll get their immunotherapy. Or after their surgery, they might need an oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And so really the medical oncologist is the end user of all that pathology information, all of the imaging information, and is really a crucial part of the treatment planning, essentially irregardless of stage now.
Yes, that term end user, I heard you use it at a talk I was at before. I thought that was an appropriate term for the medical oncologist. Patients get to a medical oncologist sometimes in different ways. Sometimes their PCP may suspect cancer based on studies or imaging and sends a patient to the oncologist without a definitive diagnosis. Sometimes there's a biopsy that is available and suspicious imaging. And then often it's just a second opinion that's being sought by a patient who's been diagnosed. When these patients show up in your office, how do you handle some of these first encounters? And I must say, some patients may come to you not knowing at all why they're there.
Yeah, there is a big variety. Sometimes, especially if they're an older adult and they're weary of getting either a biopsy or a bronchoscopy, sometimes all we have is that we know that there's a nodule and they want to know about their treatment options even before proceeding with a tissue diagnosis. So I've really seen the gamut, because nothing is risk-free, right? And I tell my patients, look, if you're interacting with the healthcare system, you know, other than a conversation, there are costs, right? There's travel costs, there can be financial implications, right? So if patients want to just have a conversation, I often start with explaining a tissue diagnosis. We really do need tissue to appropriately treatment plan, but depending on their comorbidities or their other medical conditions, we can talk about the different options. And if we don't have a tissue biopsy right off the bat, I will often get a blood test to perform tumor genomic testing. And so we know that circulating tumor DNA is in the peripheral blood. So often, if I'm suspicious that it is has already spread based on the imaging, I can get those tumor genomic testing results back within a week's time. And right away, we can start even thinking about the treatment options. And so while we're considering what is the safest biopsy option, is it a bronchoscopy? Is it a CT-guided biopsy? What is the safest approach for the patient? And then because we really do, especially if it's in the more advanced setting, but now even with neoadjuvant chemotherapy and immunotherapy, we need that PD-L1 to see if we should be using immunotherapy upfront, particularly if we're seeing N2 positive nodes and we're considering neoadjuvant chemo IO prior to surgical resection, things like that, or even adjuvant immunotherapy after chemotherapy and immunotherapy. So we really still need a combination of PD-L1 and tumor genomic testing, as well as, you know, making sure we're imaging the brain to make sure there's not occult brain mets, things like that.
So you outlined quite a few options that could exist depending on what's going on. And where do you fit in that to that, the role of the clinical trials? I know to advance science, these trials are very important, but how do you bring that up with patients who may or may not be interested?
So we are actually able, that first new patient visit phone call, we're asking them right away, are you interested in learning about clinical trials? And those could be treatment trials with new drugs, or they could be supportive care clinical trials. And that's a lot of what I do in my research program is design and implement supportive care interventions. So it could be nutrition, physical therapy, relaxation, getting people to move more to boost their immune system. So our drugs maybe work better, right? If we're trying to be more mobile and preserve functional status. So right off the bat, you can ask your patients, are you interested in treatment trials with newer cancer drugs? Or maybe it's the sequencing of the drugs that's the novel aspect of the clinical trial, or a supportive care intervention. So it's great to have a variety of different types of clinical trials because we really think both are incredibly important and can advance the field. There's also some financial toxicity, you know, interventions that can be critically important to patients or monitoring their symptoms, right? We know can really affect quality of life and survival. So right away with that first phone call, we are asking our patients, hey, when you come in for your visit, do you want more information? And the majority of the time they will say yes, right? Because information is, you know, knowledge is power. So a lot of people do want to hear, am I eligible? And the thing that we really focus on a lot as a geriatric oncologist is making sure that eligibility criteria for clinical trials aren't too strict, because I think traditionally we really have pre-selected the healthiest patients to be on clinical trials. But then when we're the drugs, let's say an example of a drug is approved, then we're using it broadly, right? And so we actually do want to get more older adults on clinical trials specifically, but because it improves the generalizability of the knowledge, because the average age of diagnosis is still around 70, but the average age of our clinical trials is closer to about 62, 65, around in that age range. So we know that we still have more work to do to get more older adults onto clinical trials to make sure that we're having a good understanding of how patients will do once these newer cancer treatments are approved. But we at an academic medical center, we are a huge center for clinical trials, but more and more are being done in the community as well, which is critical because that's where the majority of patients still get treated.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. I mentioned earlier the explosion in therapies, and I think most of them are for non-small cell lung cancer. So before we get into that, Can you tell us if there have been many advances in small cell lung cancer? And if not, what are the maybe reasons why we haven't been able to progress?
Yeah, so we haven't made as much progress, but we've still made significant progress as well in small cell. And the most recent really being using immunotherapy in the extensive stage setting in combination with chemotherapy. And though it's not necessarily curing the majority of patients, we are starting to see long-term, many-year survivors, 3-4 years out now, that we never used to see that before. So immunotherapy has also moved into the small cell lung cancer space. We have some newer chemotherapies as well, but there's also some other interesting therapeutics, not for small cell, but also non-small cell, like antibody drug conjugates and cellular therapies as well that are moving into this space, in addition to our chemotherapy and immunotherapy.
The last time I checked, I think the NCCN has guidelines about biomarker testing. When I checked, I think there were 11 specific targeted mutations that have specific therapy recommendations tied to them, both first and second line options. Can you briefly speak about the significance of these advances in targeted therapies? You mentioned it earlier, but I think we both see the fact that this needs to be done a little more regularly.
Absolutely. So every patient with an advanced diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer really needs to have tumor genomic testing. And not only is it important now for every patient with advanced or when it's spread and isn't necessarily curable with either surgery or radiation, but we know that after surgery, that some of these drugs are approved now in the postoperative setting as well. So any surgical specimen, any biopsy really should have tumor genomic testing done because it opens up a whole other category of treatments that are available now. But we know that that's not necessarily happening for every patient. And so the implications are, in the advanced setting, putting someone on a pill rather than having to put an IV in and give them systemic therapy such as chemotherapy or immunotherapy. We know that the prognosis for these patients can be dramatically different. We know that whether or not the disease may or may not affect the brain is dramatically different. So it absolutely is I would say, cornerstone now of treating non-small cell lung cancer in the current age that we're in.
I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I wanted you to talk a little bit more about the importance of when a patient and where a patient begins their cancer treatment and what the importance of the timeline of the therapies are involved.
So that's a great segue, because we really, in order to get the right treatment, you need to have that tumor genomic testing and PD-L1 testing done. And the hard part is we know that initial diagnosis period is the most stressful for patients, and they want to start treatment immediately. And I can only imagine how stressful that is. However, we know that if we start a treatment quickly before we have that information, it can sometimes be the wrong treatment. And then if we switch treatments when that information comes back to us, if we switch treatments, we can actually worsen side effects if the sequencing isn't exactly correct. So it is incredibly hard, but when we're able to explain to patients and their care partners the importance of starting the right treatment, not just the fastest treatment, most people will understand that we really need to make sure we have the right treatment plan prior to just starting whatever can be done the fastest.
This maybe fits into the next question I was going to ask was, what would be a good recommendation for either a primary care doctor or a pulmonologist when they first see a patient diagnosed with lung cancer? What should be their approach and what should they discuss with that patient?
Right. So they should be screening them, number one. That should be top of mind, not just, you know, their mammogram or their PSA or their colonoscopy, but actually getting that low-dose CT scan. So screening should be the number one thing, but then also appropriate referral to get either a bronchoscopy for staging or a biopsy. Getting a biopsy, you know, immediately when you see that there is a lung nodule, but again, there are many programs that follow lung nodules over time, because not every nodule, right, is going to be a lung cancer, but getting them referred to either a lung nodule program, there are many available, to follow that nodule over time. And if it does get large enough, to not just forget about it, right? And if patients go to the emergency department, let's say, and get a chest x-ray or a scan, really trying to be proactive about following up on the results, because that we've seen that, you know, many times where there is a nodule, but it sort of just gets lost to follow up. And I think we're getting better, but we still have a long way to go in terms of following these, you know, incidentalomas, for lack of a better word, right? And so making sure that there's a good follow-up plan, and then if it is large enough or looks concerning, to getting a biopsy or referring to a pulmonologist, because even now with these much smaller nodules, you know, we have navigational bronchoscopy that can get to these areas that we weren't able to get to just a few years ago.
Yeah, excellent advice and a good point about how the technology is moving us along with bronchoscopy as well. As in many things in medical care, equity and access show disparities among different populations that we treat. Can you comment on how you see this playing out in your practice or institution? And it sounds like age is certainly an important part of what you deal with as well.
Absolutely. So I don't think there should be, you know, any age cutoff for that, at least a conversation, right? And so I really don't turn anyone away, because if they want to talk about what treatment looks like, I think that's an important conversation to have. And it's critical for shared decision making, right? And you want to, you know, first do no harm, but having a conversation about the risks and benefits of screening, diagnosis, treatment, prognosis, all of these things are incredibly important to think about. Chronologic age is not necessarily equivalent to biologic or physiologic age. So even if someone is 50, they could be frail and be have accelerated aging, right? Depending on the exposures or lifestyle habits or behaviors. Whereas somebody in their 70s or 80s could really be as functional as somebody, you know, 10, 15 years younger. So what I really encourage clinicians, physicians, whether they're, you know, physicians or advanced practice practitioners, nurses, is to really understand, what does a typical day look like for you? And what are you able to do? What do you wish you were able to do, right? Because that really gives you more of an understanding of their function in terms of, are they able to do all of their activities of daily living and instrumental activities of daily living, or do they have mobility disability, right? Because that can really affect what treatment, if they are screened, diagnosed, right? The treatment planning. And we know that a geriatric assessment can really decrease the treatment-related toxicities that older patients experience.
Well, you certainly seem to be at the cutting edge of treatment for your patients in a broad way. I was going to ask you, what do you see the future as far as the care of the lung cancer patient? Where are we headed with all these different therapies?
Yeah, so where I hope we're headed is really this we already have this rapidly expanding menu of lung cancer treatments, but my hope is that everyone who needs to be screened gets screened. We continue to diagnose it at an earlier stage, but regardless of the stage, we are delivering not only precision medicine, but really personalized lung cancer care. And that survivorship, it really starts at diagnosis. It's not after you're done with your treatment. And we're really treating the cancer, but we're also treating the whole person. And that's really the approach that we try to take, because mental health, physical health, it's all related to how you function and your quality of life. So I really am hopeful for a personalized whole patient approach, regardless of treatment, prognosis, but really living well with lung cancer.
Great concluding comments. So thanks again to Dr. Presley for joining us today. As I said at the top, we have a great archive of lung cancer discussions on our show feeds, the most recent ones being a talk with Dr. David Cook, a thoracic surgeon whose role in lung cancer was explained, and also Dr. Carla Lamb reflected on the decades worth of advances in lung cancer interventions from an instrumental standpoint. So be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.